Hey guys, we're back with another episode of Behind the Vinyl for another week, and we're happy to have Jay from Slipknot.
Hello.
Hey.
Nice.
Welcome aboard, man.
Thank you for having me.
So we kind of instead of throwing over, often we'd throw the record, the choice over to you. We kind of thought it would come back as a Neurosis or a Converge or a something like that.
That's, yeah.
And we will do that next time.
Is that because I'm wearing a Neurosis Converge hoodie right now?
It's not, but we figured Neurosis is your favorite band.
Yeah,
right?
Well, yeah, my reputation precedes me, I guess. Yeah, you know, those are two bands that have been hugely influential in my life, for sure.
Yep. Nice. As is the band that we're picking, Slipknot, the first record.
Sure. Yeah.
Hugely influential.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, in many more ways than one. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, of course, you're with Slipknot, but let's dig a little bit back. Your father is a musician, so you're around music your whole time.
Yeah.
From what I understand, he took you to your first show, which was Ozzfest.
Yeah, my first metal show of that kind of music was Ozzfest 2001, I believe, and I was 10 years old. I had been to some shows before, just kind of dipping my feet into the water as far as, honestly, for the first, 5 years of my life, I didn't even know what, guitar-driven music was. I didn't know what rock and roll was and everything, which is incredibly ironic considering that, my dad was in a band and everything. Yeah. So, but that wasn't really a part of my, active life. I was raised on a lot of, classical music when I was a kid. And then when I was five, we had the opportunity as a family to go see The Who perform Quadrophenia at Madison Square Garden.
Nice.
So that was my first show, and that just completely, it blew the doors wide open. And it was stuff I'd never heard, loud guitars like that and everything. So that was kind of where I started developing a sense of what rock and roll was. And then, from there it was the Rolling Stones and the Beatles and stuff like that. But for heavy metal, for, that kind of, wholly different take on the genre of rock and roll, that all started for me. My exposure to that started with going to that Ozzfest show in 2001. And that was from an invitation from Slipknot.
All right. Yeah. There we go. That's nice.
Well, we were talking about that. There's a photo going around, right?
Yeah.
Of you dressed up as Corey.
Yeah.
So cool.
That was a little bit later after I had become accustomed to, the music and became a fan and stuff and did my homework, did my research, got the albums, and right when I had seen them for the first time, that was right before Iowa had come out.
Right.
And so it was really just the first record, maybe some a song might have been floating around from Iowa at that point in time. But I had never heard of Slipknot, heard Slipknot's music, seen a photo of Slipknot. I'd never seen anything before that first experience of at that time, it was still something that a lot of people, even though it was growing in popularity, Slipknot wasn't exactly something that everybody knew. And, in a lot of ways today, Slipknot's kind of a household name. But back in 2001, it was still something that, I feel like the band was still on this, trajectory of trying to get people to recognize what the band was doing, So having my first impression of the band be just right up close, seeing it for the first time, I mean it was complete sensory overload for me. It's been it's been a wild ride ever since.
Was that the first Ozzfest that they played when they were on the side stage?
No, so that would have been in 1999, right before the first album came out. This was 2 years later. So the band had been on the Conan O'Brien TV show, which my dad played drums on.
Right.
And, he would see bands every night coming on the show. And they came on to the Conan show promoting the first album. And he was like, oh, this band is totally insane. They wear masks. They play this wild music. And they're really great guys. They, came up and said, hey, if you and your family ever want to come to a show, come on out. And we did. That's really what happened,
Well, that photo is just it's so surreal.
Yeah.
So there you are as a kid. Standing with the mask and everything. Well, and then just a couple of years later, you're in the band.
Yeah, a couple, 2-3 years later.
Yeah.
That was funny. That was on Halloween night, actually,
right.
On the Pledge of Allegiance tour.
Right.
And my friend and I went trick-or-treating as members of Slipknot, and his parents actually wouldn't let him go to the show.
Oh, really?
So I went, and yeah, that was the second time as I had gotten to, you know, be more familiar with the band, and then they're like, hey, it's you again.
But it's also, from a different perspective, the Slipknot must have been freaking out as well, because it's Max, it's your father,
yeah,
you know, freaking out, you know, about him being there, you know, and playing on the Conan show and having him, you know, that must have been a big thing for them.
Yeah, and you know, I've heard from the guys, because, you know, all the guys in the band have such a diverse musical taste and respect for, you know, lineage of music and stuff like that, and we talk about that there was kind of like, from the get-go when they had met him, there was kind of this relationship of like, they could tell this guy who's been around the block, done rock and roll for a long time, was seeing this fresh new band as like, hey, this is something exciting and new and different, and I respect this, even though I have no idea what it is or what, you know, or what it's about or where it comes from. You know, taking his own, you know, not to speak for my dad, but to kind of take from his experience and be like, this is something I could get into. This is something I could back, because there's something really good here. And I think that was kind of like, they felt that in their first meeting, that it wasn't just some like, wow, you guys are totally crazy and I'm not going to ever let my kid go to one of your shows. No, it was something with, you know, a lot of respect there. And that's, you know, that's a credit to the guys in Slipknot for really drawing, you know, drawing that like that parallel between like, hey, there's not too much difference between, you know, Slipknot and Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band and Max Weinberg and stuff. Like there's this common family of music that they saw that respect there right away. And that's you know, that's something that's very important to this band, is, you know, the lineage of music and how we're all one thing, you know.
Mm.
Momentum is doing me out. Fuck it all. Fuck this world. Fuck
bringing back to the record, I've heard there's stories about how your mother wouldn't let you buy the record, but your father ended up when you're on holidays or something fine.
That's true.
Is that a true story?
That is true. Yeah. Yeah. You know, she was a little bit skeptical at first because, you know, she reads the lyrics and she's like, oh, God, I don't know if I can get behind this. Which is incredibly ironic because now she comes to the shows and she sings every single word and stuff. But, you know, back then, trying to figure out what I was getting into and everything, she was like, I don't know about this. And I was just persistent. I was like, this is going to be my favorite band. I really want to have this record, blah, blah, blah. You know, I'm a 10-year-old kid. And I remember, yeah, we were in California for some reason, and the Tower Records on Sunset Boulevard, that doesn't even exist anymore. I remember, like, my dad just pulled into the Tower Records, walked in, got a copy of the first Slipknot record, and just handed it to me. And I opened it there. And I had, you know, something that I had been clamoring for. This is probably shortly after that Ozfest show. I'd just been like, I got to get this record. And so it's finally after that he was like, all right, here you go. And so I put it in my little Discman, and I was a, you know, happy little 10-year-old.
What kind of impact did it have on you? I mean, listening to it the first couple of times and...
Such an enormous impact, you know. Being that impressionable at that age, having been exposed to, you know, rock and roll and punk rock and stuff on a very, like, surface level, this was something that, like, penetrated completely deeper. It was something unlike anything I had heard before. So to be there and listening to all these layers of sound, but it all made sense to me, you know, it's all so, like, instinctual, you know, for a kid to be 10 years old and feel that strong of a connection to that kind of music, that's really powerful, to translate that kind of emotion and intensity and anger and frustration or whatever, and starting to feel that as, you know, just a kid growing up in the world. You know, for a band to make music that translates to somebody, you know, not just my age now, but my age then, that's huge, you know? So it was incredibly impactful, instinctual, visceral. And I knew that this was going to be kind of the start of the soundtrack of my life. And, you know, that sent me on a spiral of learning where does this music come from? What are the other bands that, you know, that share in this and stuff? And that developed my education about, you know, heavier music and let me down the wormhole that we all go down, you know? So, but that was the very first thing that kind of kicked me off that cliff was the first Slipknot album for sure.
Son, 'cause he's a fan, so I'm a mystery, and that leaves me nothing. Many times, if you wanted to die, it's too late for me. All you have to do is get rid of me. You get to California with a mother better die. Get to California with a mother better die. You can't see California with a mother better die. It's all in your head. It's all in my head. It's all in your head. So long, everywhere I go.
Looking at the set list from last night from that record, you're still playing five songs from that. It's pretty crazy. I think you're playing Sick, you're playing Eyeless, Wait and Bleed, Spit It Out, and Surfacing.
Yeah, we don't play Spit anymore though.
Oh, you don't?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, but we you know, we typically do. We play a lot. We do play a lot off the first album.
Right. Yeah. So that's great that 20 years on, these songs are still.
Longevity
of these songs is unbelievable.
Yeah, it is amazing. They're pillars of this music. You know, these songs are definitely, you know, they're mainstays of what heavy metal is all about, in my opinion. You know, in my view, and I think a lot of people share in that.
A lot of people talk about the masks and all that kind of stuff, but as a physical element, how was it to, and how did you teach yourself to play in the mask? You know, because it's obviously constricting in regards to breathing, also vision, all that kind of stuff.
It's an interesting way to put that, because it's almost like I didn't have to teach myself, like kind of it taught me in a way, you know, because it's just one of those things where it's like, you know, coming into the band, I knew that was a factor of it. You know, I knew that was going to be something that, because we started playing together without shows in mind. Like, shows were so far from our thought. We started working on new music right away. You know, the first day I joined in the band, we were working on new songs. So the live show was kind of distant, but I knew it, at the end of this process of making a record and rehearsing and stuff, it's like, okay, the masks are, that's an obstacle I'm going to have to encounter. So really it's something that it just teaches me, you know, it tells me kind of how to submit to the performance. And, you know, it's another thing where, like, when we practice sometimes without the masks, it feels weird, you know. Honestly, it kind of gives you, it gives you this extra layer of just like something where now, you know, you're not so, like, you're a little bit shielded from everything, and you're shielded behind this giant wall of sound and volume and intensity and music. And so, you know, the mask kind of provides another layer of that, and it's artistic and it's expression. And, you know, to me, that was such a beautiful thing as growing up to be a fan of the band. You know, the band was an army and had a unified vision, clearly a unified uniform, you know, where everything was one unit, but the individual expression was all different for each guy. You know, it wasn't nine of the same masks. Every guy had their own expression of their own personality through it. And that was so interesting to me, that it was this unified vision, but each guy, you could identify more with this guy or this guy or this guy. And so, you know, as time progressed, as I kind of had my, like my new guy mask, you know, that was kind of like, all right, we're jumping you into this band, and this is what it is, and this represents this band in this way, and you're going to have to find yourself in it. And I feel like that over time developed into that, you know, it, like, on the last mask that I had, the last touring cycle that we did, I only had the one mask, and it's became disgusting, and it fell apart, eroded, and it's just disgusting now, but it took on its own character that was, I felt, very much more me. And then, you know, as we're making new songs for a second album together, then, you know, the ideas come from, like, okay, where am I going to take my mask in another artistic direction? And you know, having played 200 shows with Slipknot, you know, before we made We Are Not Your Kind, that informed where I would take the art of my mask to kind of make it an evolution from where it was before. And yeah, that, you know, it's obviously a staple part of the band's expression. And so to kind of jump into that was, it was a total experience, but I let it kind of more teach me more than I kind of inform it, you know.
This is a silly question, but have you ever written, have you ever written with it?
We're good. It's, yeah, we can keep going. Right. Yeah. Okay.
again, it's a silly question, but have you ever written something and thought, you know what, I'm going to have to, before I see the guys, I'm going to have to put it on and actually see whether it's physically possible to play with it?
That's funny. I've never had that experience. It's always been, you know, for us, like, the music always comes first. So I don't think, and this is my own kind of approach to it, but I think I could probably speak for the rest of the guys, is that, like, none of us would make our music with the information of, like, okay, well, then I'm going to have to play this with a mask on and have to play it with these uncomfortable clothes on. Like, we don't think about that at all. Like, the music 100% comes first, because I think with anything else coming into that, we might start to cut corners and be like, oh shit, well, I'm going to be wearing a mask, so I'm not going to be able to breathe, so I got to make this part a little easier or whatever. Like, that's not a thought at all in our process. So when we're concentrating on writing music, it's so much like complete isolation, just talking about the sound and the, you know, where the music is going, what direction we want to push the music, or what direction we want the music to push us. Then once all the songs come together, honestly, like, everything else, and this has been my experience for the last record and this new record, is that, like, once we got pretty much almost to the end of making a record, we did it with The Great Chapter and now with We Are Not Your Kind, then the other elements start to show their face. Then we start thinking about, like, okay, what's the stage going to be like? What are our masks going to be like? What are our outfits going to be like? Like, that all comes, it kind of gets informed by where the music has taken us to this point. And then we start to see it visually, like, okay, I'm starting to see these songs as represented in my mask, as represented in my outfit I'm going to wear on stage. So that kind of comes at, like, the end of the process. For me, that was definitely the case. Once I finished, like, my drums and I started to hear the songs really come together, I could start to feel what the album was kind of telling us what it was going to be. And that kind of informs all the other stuff. I felt the air rise up in me, kneel down, clear the stone of leaves. I wander out where you can't see, inside my shell I wait and bleed. I felt the air rise up in me, kneel down, clear the stone of leaves. I wander out where you can't see, inside my shell I wait and bleed. Goodbye, a weapon of our time. Everything is turning past for me. My eyes are running cold. The air is standing straight up. This is not the way I picture me. I can't control my shakes. How the hell did I get here? Something about this so very wrong. I have to laugh out loud. I wish I didn't like this. Is it a dream or a memory?
An interesting thing about that first album, and I just read it today, was that Ross Robinson, he threw plants Joey Jordison, as he was recording his drums, so he had to duck, and he kept knocking the instruments out of the hands of the band members and screaming at them, you can play that shit harder. A very interesting way of recording an album.
That's a very peculiar and interesting way to record an album. But, you know, there's a million ways to pet a cat, so.
Yeah. But I've heard you also say in the past, it's very challenging in the studio, like everyone pushes everyone to the limit, creatively.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've also played, you were 17 years old, you played with, you know, Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band. You played with Madball, you played with Against Me, but I heard you said that Slipknot are by far the most talented and challenging musicians you've ever played with.
100%, yeah. You know, and that's not a knock to any musicians that I played with in the past, you know, especially with Bruce and the E Street Band. That's a whole other caliber of rock and roll. That's, you know, rock and roll legends and legacies and my actual bloodline family, you know. You know, and that was its own set of challenges at that time, for sure, that I had to learn. I mean, when I started playing with Bruce, I had only been playing drums for about three or four years.
Jesus.
That's crazy. That's
yeah.
So then, you know, fast forward time, learning on the road, touring nonstop and whatever, and then getting the opportunity to play with Slipknot, that all of a sudden, the very first time we played together, it was all of a sudden like, oh my God, this is a whole other league of musicianship, of crafting songs and pushing each other. Because that was, you know, and I've been in recording situations before, but definitely nothing like Slipknot. When we were making 0.5 The Gray Chapter, my understanding of making records to that point was like, okay, so this is probably going to take a while, so this is probably going to take, like, I don't know, 3-4 weeks, you know, to make this album. Because in my experience, you do all your drum tracks in, like, 1 or 2 days, you know? And so I was like, okay, so this is a big band. We're probably going to, you know, probably take, like, a month to do this album or something. It took us 7 months, you know, to make that record. It took me, like, you know, a month and a half of just doing my drums and recording drums, going back, re-recording drums, figuring out like, okay, now you're in a groove. Let's redo all those other songs that we did.
Wow.
All that stuff, you know, and it was with the guidance of the guys in the band, with the guidance of Greg Fiddleman, our producer.
Fucking Greg Fiddleman. He's a master.
Yeah. So, you know, with their guidance of kind of, you know, of pushing me to my limits, you know, it was really funny. Like, one day that we had in the studio, right when they were kind of still like, that whole recording process to me kind of felt like my big, like a big long audition process. You know, there's the first day of us jamming together. That was kind of like, quote, the audition, you know, where we played a bunch of stuff from the back catalog.
Did you know that? Was that just in your bloodline? Because they didn't tell you you were auditioning for Slipknot, right?
Yeah, no, it was literally going off of muscle memory from when I was like 14 years old, being in my freezing shed in New Jersey, playing along to albums and, you know, that had gone from playing to Ramones albums to, okay, I'm going to try to play along to a Metallica album, try to play it along to a Slayer album, try to play along to a Slipknot album. You know, that's how I taught myself how to play drums. Like, I never took any lessons or anything like that. So it was always, I was taught by the bands that I loved. And so it was all from muscle memory from me being a kid going in and playing those songs. You know, we played like 20 something songs, and that was kind of like, that was it. You know, that was the beginning and ending of our conversation of, you know, do you want to play with us? Was like, can you play these songs? We played 20 something songs, and then we started writing new material right there. So, but you know, with the guidance of those guys and, you know, kind of having me really just completely like blow my brains out in the studio every day. There was one day in particular, Clown, Jim, Greg Fiddleman and I were in the studio for like a month, working on these arrangements that Jim had. And we get going and they want to just throw the book at me. Just go absolutely nuts in every single measure of music in this song. Just go totally crazy. And we would break down a song into like 5-second increments to be like, what are you going to do here? That's totally insane. And so we did that throughout the course of a day. We took one song and literally everything was just as crazy as it could be, to the point where at the end of the day, we're like so fried and we're just like, oh my God, you know, all right, let's come back tomorrow and listen. And we come back in the morning and we press play and we're like, what the fuck did we just make? Like, it's this like monstrosity of a drum solo that has guitar riffs to it. And they're like, okay. Let's slow down. You got the job. Okay. You can hang with us. So then it was a matter of like, you know, schooling the way of thought as to, you know, making new Slipknot music, because with this band, it's always facing forward. It's never looking in the rearview mirror. And but it was important for me, you know, with the first day that I started jamming with the band, I was like, you know, these guys aren't expecting me to have this stuff down pat, cold, you know, ready to go, learned. But if I can show them that I know the energy of this band and I know the integrity of this band and what sort of, it was just a vibe. I need to just translate a vibe. And if I can translate that vibe, that they'll know that I know what this band is about, that's going to go further than me nailing a, you know, how to play Before I Forget or something like that, you know? But so that carried into everything we've done since then, you know? And yeah, we push each other really, really hard in the studio because we really, really care. Like, we really care about this music. And, you know, we try to respectfully, you know, break down those barriers of like, you know, nobody's going to come into a studio and just say like, well, that's not good enough. That's not, you know, this and that. But we, you know, we all have a barometer of what we want this band to be because we want to make the best music we possibly can. And so we're going to push each other until we feel like a song is heading in a certain direction. And that song doesn't get finished until we feel like it has been pushed to the place where we're happy with it. And, you know, we don't really take any outside information at all about our music. You know, it's what we want to make. And we care about it, so we'll take months and months and months to work on one single song. But at the end of that, and it could drive us totally crazy, but at the end of that, we have something that we're really proud of to, you know, to play on stage. Like, for instance, tonight, you know, we'll play songs that took a lot of headaches and throwing things up against the wall and throwing certain things at certain people. And you know, it is really the way about this band. And it's just like, it really just boils down to the fact that we care. And it boils down to the fact that we, you know, we take this really seriously. So, you know, once they saw, I think, you know, this is going back 2 records, but once they saw that I was on board for that and that, you know, I'm down to be pushed and I'm down to push back to make things better, you know, I think they saw like, okay, this guy's one of us.
Did you never give a damn in the first place? Maybe it's time you were the tables turned, cause in the interest of all involved, I got the problem solved and the verdict is guilty. And I'll get my time away, I'm here to try and stop dropping off. You were dead from the get-go, bit motherfucker. Took a cock, stuck a race, scared of me now. Then you dumb than I thought, always is and never was. Don't measure me to pierce and bear the cure. Don't tell me, ask me, think I fear your bullshit. Choose another, don't blow, drop it up this shit. Here's another way to break through the noise. With a circle that has had to catch a bend. Gotta be that way if you want it. Sanity, literal profanity, if mad. Yeah.
record straight. All the needle nose punching is making me irate. Sticking my picture falling under fears. Where you gonna be in the next 5 years? The cool one, all the fools, and all the politics. Get your lips ready, gonna gang, gonna make you sick. You got dick when they find out the good stuff, bam. Are you sick of me? Good enough, enough. Fuck me, I'm all out of enemies. 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 Fuck me, I'm all out of enemies.
I'm just thinking that, that there's a lot of, on your Facebook page, there's a lot of GoPro stuff posted.
Shout out GoPro.
Yeah, but it's really cool, and that's the cool thing these days with the technology, that it really puts you smack dab in the middle of the show, watching you play.
Yeah, it's a fun, you know, it's a fun thing to do that kind of gives, like, you know, I'm a fan of drummers, I'm a fan of musicians, so to give a little bit of a different insight that you don't get to see, you know, it's, you can't get a ticket to our show that gets you as close as that, yeah, you know, yeah. So I feel given a little bit of an insight to people that follow along with what we do, it's a fun way of kind of, you know, showing a different element of the show.
Yeah, yep. Definitely.
Just to touch on your dad a little bit, obviously you were super close, you know, as a kid, as a 10-year-old, he'd take you to shows.
Yeah.
I heard you guys you'd come and see him when he was at Conan, and then you go at CBGBs and catch bands,
yeah,
and saw Mastodon and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Now in a band like Slipknot, do you ever give him, you're obviously meeting on a different plane now. It's not just father and son, it's two of the best and most recognized drummers in the world. Do you ever... Does he ever to you, and do you ever to him, call for advice or question him about things and riff off each other, so to speak?
Yeah, well, we talk all the time. You know, he's my best friend. He's my father. He's, you know, it's all those things. You know, we have a great, great father-son relationship that's, you know, become a whole new thing as a drummer to drummer relationship, you know, too. That wasn't something like he planned. He never put drumsticks in my hand. He never, you know, never... always was encouraging of what I wanted to do when drums became something I wanted to do, he was all about it, because yep. He was like, oh, well, this is what I know, you know? So the fact that, you know, he and I, when I was like 17, you know, my developing years of like 14 through 17, I was like, you know, trying to figure out what I'm doing with drums, and had bands in high school. And then when I was 17, I played with his band for the first time. And, you know, that took our relationship to a whole nother level. And yeah, you know, we talk about music all the time. We talk about drumming all the time. We talk about, you know, just honestly, just like being growing up as a person. You know, I'm almost 30 years old. And so just, you know, growing up, being an adult, and just sharing in what his adult life was. Like, I feel like when you hit a certain age, and, you know, I'm very fortunate to have a close relationship with both my parents, that, you know, I'm able to talk to them about just like adult things, not things that like were, you know, I don't know, trivial 15-year-old bullshit kind of things. It's, yeah, like, you know, it's really great to have two people that are genuinely always, you know, they've always been in my corner, always been very supportive. You know, whatever bands I was in, especially this one, they've always come out to the shows, worn the t-shirts, and yeah, Mom's in the pit, you know, stirring it up, singing along to all the words. So yeah, but you know, my dad and I, we definitely recognize that we have something special that's pretty unique in the world, where, you know, we're two drummers. I can't think of another, you know, father-son duo that got to share drumming responsibilities in the same band actively at the same time.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so to have that kind of relationship and that special like rock and roll kind of moment that, you know, that we still live in, you know, in a way, it's really, you know, it's a blessing. We really cherish our connection like that, and it's just had us, you know, grow closer. We don't live near each other, but we're still very, very close.
Do you ever jam together? Like do drum battles and stuff like that?
We have before. We have only a couple times. All right. And I think the only times we've ever done it have been on camera. You know, like all right. Yeah, we never have just kind of like sat down at two kits just to do it, but we've always been like presented with a certain challenge and been like, yeah, let's do that. That'd be cool. You know, like we got asked to do some friends of ours had a drum off. They were putting on a drum off with Guitar Center. So they asked us if we would do an interpretation of a swing song where, you know, my dad's known for right. swing drumming and big band cool, and jazz sure. and all that kind of stuff. In addition to his rock and roll background. And me, I'm this just like punk rock kid in a Gigi Allen shirt. And I'm just like, you know, I'm going to come up and wail on these drums the way I know how. And they're like, yeah, we want that. You know, we want to show two guys that share the same last name but come from two completely different ways of interpreting music. Like, that'd be cool. So we've done that before. You know, I tell people it's funny because, like, you couldn't have two people who are more closely, literally related, but two completely different drummers. Right. Like we're very, very different drummers that kind of come from the same place but ended up at two very different places.
Yeah. Speaking of that, what is you're now living in Nashville?
Yes,
very very musical city. Everyone yeah. seems to be living there. I can remember the first time I went to Nashville. I went to this with one of the bands I was working. This little bar, and these dudes were jamming, and it was actually Johnny Cash's band.
Oh, right.
Just sitting there, fucking jamming on a Tuesday night just for money. What has that brought to you playing? You
know, Nashville?
It
brings a lot. There's a really great little close-knit kind of like punk and hardcore community that I really like. A lot of talented bands come from there. Chamber, Orthodox, you know, there's a lot of great musicians in Nashville that aren't just, you know, your stereotypical country or pop or you know, light rock and roll kind of stuff. Like, you know, there is that, obviously, but people who kind of come from our world are there as well. And I love it. You know, I grew up on the East Coast. I grew up in New Jersey and lived right outside New York City for most of my life. So, you know, when I went to college right outside New York, like literally on the other side of the Hudson, and living that like really intense kind of like, you know, you're in a sardine can most of the time, you know, you're on the subway and stuff. That was my way of life and I didn't know anything different. But then when I moved to Nashville, all of a sudden I've just felt this like huge exhale. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe that I was like so like tightly wound and lived in, you know, I love New York and I love New Jersey, but it's just a way of life that's very much more like compressed and compacted. Whereas when I went to Nashville, it's still a creative community and creative scene. There are artists, there are musicians, but I felt like I could breathe better. I felt like I just had more space to explore and relax. And, you know, New Jersey has a little bit of everything. There's definitely like room to breathe and relax and get out in the woods and stuff. But there's something about, you know, the Southern way of living in Nashville and Tennessee that's just really special and speaks to my interests. You know, I'm a huge hockey fan and we have a National Hockey League team down in Nashville that I love and follow dearly. So, you know, there's a lot of things that drew me there, and it's absolutely my home. It's where I met my fiance, and it's, you know, it's just like it's my place for sure.
Love it.
Nice.
Okay, we're going to wrap it up. Let's come full circle, just finish it with the record. We'll go out with one of the songs. Is there a song on here that you enjoy playing the most, or that challenges you the most?
The song that I enjoy the most off of we're talking about the self-titled Slipknot yeah. album. God, you know, I daydream about songs that we don't play that yeah. I'd really like to play. I love playing the songs that we do play, but man, I would love to tap into. I just love the challenge of doing something that we don't usually do.
Yeah.
See,
that would be a great fucking Slipknot show, like Slipknot the deep cuts.
Right, dude. Yeah, honestly,
that would be
insane. Honestly, and you know, obviously, I'm just one person in this band that might feel this way, but it's like, man, I want to do something where we play like Slipknot, the weird stuff, right. You know, yeah. only the Skin Ticket and Scissors and Tattered and Torn,
yeah.
Prelude, the Nameless, the Virus of Life, stuff like that. I want to do a show of all that kind of stuff. But that's just me. no, but you know, if I were to pick a song off here, let's go with Sick. I mean, that's just, you know, you turn on the record and you hear the whole thing I think is sick, and you're like, what the fuck is this? I didn't even know what that girl was saying.
Right.
I was like, the hot thalak, blah 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 blah, like, what is this? And then all of a sudden 30 seconds later you're just bah, 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 and you're just, I'm a 10-year-old kid, I'm just like, what did I just turn on? So let's go with Sick. That's, you know, that's such a pillar of this band, that's you know, a mission statement for this band. So yeah, let's go with Sick.
Alrighty, let's go out with that. Thank you for your time.
Thank
you. Absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Have a great show tonight, and we will see you very soon.
See you soon.
Just begun. It's about that time. Gotta get mine. Just begun. It's about that time. Gotta get mine.